This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. School administrators in Spokane County can begin moving ahead with their planning now that the initial wave of ballots has been counted in Tuesday's special election. More votes are still to be counted during the next week or so, but all of the issues for the 12 school districts appear to be winning by comfortable margins. Some administrators are crediting social media for helping with their successful campaigns. The Citizens Committee for the Central Valley School District did some campaigning for the district's levy and bond issue in the traditional way. This ad appeared on at least one local TV station.
In Central Valley, we have a history of completing our school bond construction work ahead of schedule and under budget. Now it's time for the next phase.
But the ad also appeared on the Central Valley Citizens for Education Facebook page. School districts are limited by law to giving out information about a particular ballot measure. They can't use taxpayer money to advocate. But groups run by parents, businesses, and other boosters have more latitude. They can create traditional media campaigns or interesting websites and make use of social media to raise awareness.
But I think it has changed elections, and I think it has become a bigger part of campaigns, especially on the citizens' campaign side of it.
That's Central Valley Superintendent Ben Small. On the other side of town, Meade Superintendent Tom Rockefeller agrees. He saw the changing face of school campaigns firsthand a few weeks ago. One night, the district held a levy open house in one of its elementary schools. Only one person showed up. Rockefeller attributed that not to a lack of interest among voters, but to the fact that people could already get the information they needed at the district's website, and they didn't want to go out on a cold weeknight.
I believe that it's going to make a campaign easier in the future because people are becoming more and more accustomed to getting online and getting actual information instead of waiting for it to come to them in print form.
In the Spokane School District, Superintendent Shelley Redinger attributes much of her district's levy passage to social media, but it's a supplement, not a replacement, of the traditional campaigns.
What we found is we still need to do the other methods of communicating as well, because there are still families, 60% of our voting population don't have children in the schools, so we have to use other methods. They still really like those face-to-face interactions and meetings. And those are really, really important. And then many of our families still like the mailings, the hard copies, the newsletters that highlight all of the different things that are going on.
The common denominator here is that districts understand communication at as many levels as possible is the way to keep voters engaged and supportive. Last week, we told you about Avista's plans to create what it calls its Catalyst Building along East Sprague in Spokane's University District. It's a building the company hopes will drive economic development using the brain power of the academic people in the district. Eastern Washington University will serve as the anchor tenant and move three of its programs from Cheney to the new building. Dean Allen is the CEO of McKinstry, the company that's designing much of the new building's infrastructure. He says the plan is to make the building a facility that needs little or no outside power.
So in this case, we'll be leveraging solar panels on the roof and potentially adjacent structures in the area.
It also will use so-called smart systems that monitor the operations of the building.
It lets you see into a lot of the data around what's happening in a building and how many people are in it and how it's occupied and how its systems are working and what its net energy consumption is, as well as what its energy excesses are.
Allen says the Catalyst Building will also serve as the first piece of something called an eco-district or an energy catalyst for the neighborhood.
Across the planet, particularly in Europe and in more older, well-established cities, they often have used what they would call district heating or district cooling systems. And an example would be in Seattle, there's a centralized steam system called Seattle Steam that can supply steam to many of the buildings in Seattle that want to have those. And the advantage of that is you can have a pretty high performing centralized system, and then each building doesn't have to buy, you know, its own boiler and its own systems, and often those smaller systems aren't as efficient. So if you aggregate all of those loads into a centralized system, you can find economies and efficiencies. The problem with that is, you know, cities evolve in their own unique way, and neighborhoods evolve in their own unique way, and they are pretty big endeavors. There are many beautiful examples of that. Toronto cools their entire downtown in air conditioning mode from deep water cooling that comes out of, off of the lake. Chicago does something similar. Many cities in Europe do the same thing. In this case, we're working really on a concept more of a neighborhood-based, what we call eco-district, which is an opportunity for centralizing on a smaller scale, but at a neighborhood scale where buildings and different occupancies can use and contribute and share energy between them. A smaller version of this would be something that McKinstry developed for Amazon here in Seattle. So Amazon's building, you know, four big giant high rises for their headquarters, amongst many other buildings, and in total about 4 or 5 million square feet just in a few blocks across the street. Another great customer of McKinstry's, Kleis, operates a very large data center, you know, 40-story building full of computers and servers. And we linked the desire of the data center to reject heat with the desire for Amazon to heat their buildings and heat their spheres. And we actually pipe the excess heat from the Kleis data center buildings across the street and into the mechanical systems of Amazon's headquarters. And the heat for those buildings comes from the waste heat of the servers across the street. So we call that an eco-district as well.
In Spokane, Alan says the eco-district would look a little different than the example in Seattle.
So the concept is that we'll have a what will look like a pretty good-sized central plant, and that plant will be matched to a series of buildings that can be built or will be built over a period of time in the South University District, and optimizing around the aggregation of all of those loads and looking for ways when buildings are producing net heat that they need to export, instead of that going out the cooling tower on the roof of that building, it goes back into the eco district and can be used by other buildings. It might be heating domestic water for showers or, you know, other domestic uses, or store that heat for other times of the day, and really getting the performance optimized across those buildings.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so could you plug existing buildings into that, or do you envision just a whole bunch of new buildings or several new buildings all tied together as part of that?
Well, it can be for both. You know, you have to do the engineering and make decisions around what you initially buy, and then you presumably set it up so that it can be a bit modular, so that as other buildings come on, you can add individual components to sort of grow that. But it's not designed to, you know, serve the whole city. You know, in theory, we envision a world where there are many of these eco-district hubs in the city, and that they're responsive to what's going on in their near neighborhood, and in some cases might be linked to others. But in this case, this will be the first one for Spokane, so it'll start by servicing the buildings that are in the immediate neighborhood, and it's a neighborhood on the grow, so it'll be mostly aimed at new buildings, but it could certainly also service an existing building.
And so who builds and operates that central plant?
Well, Avista and McKinstry are going to partner to do that.
Dean Allen is the CEO of McKinstry, which has a Spokane office in the University District. He joined us from Seattle. Construction of the Catalyst building is scheduled to start in the fall and take about 18 months. Credit Whitworth University with good timing this week. On Monday evening, President Beck Taylor interviewed Ali Nirani, the head of the National Immigration Forum, at a public event on campus. The National Immigration Forum bills itself as an organization that, quote, convenes a broad constituency from across the country in constructive conversation and dedicated work to advocate for the value of immigrants and immigration to the nation. It just so happened this chat came on the same day the U.S. Senate began debating immigration issues, and so the issue is fresh on people's minds. We'll spend a few minutes listening to excerpts, starting with Beck Taylor's question.
But what is it about the last, say, 3 or 4 years mm-hmm. where, I mean, I don't think this was the topic of conversation at Whitworth 5 or 6 years ago,
yep.
the way it is today. What is unique about our time in the American mm-hmm. story? Why has yep. immigration risen to the top?
Well, I think, first of all, As the country has become more diverse, it's not just more diverse in California or New York or Florida. You know, now the fastest growth in the foreign-born population is in the Southeast. You know, I know in the Spokane area, you've seen a growing level of diversity in the schools and throughout the region. And that wasn't happening 10 years ago. It wasn't happening 8 years ago. And those demographic changes are challenging us. They're challenging those of us who have been in a community for decades, and they're challenging us who are coming to a community in more recently. And what I've found is that all of us have to change as a result. And do we have the leadership within our communities to help us navigate that change? A lot of us grew up thinking that our politicians would help us lead that change. But as our politics have changed and have become even more divisive and polarizing, it's harder and harder for an elected official, and I'm talking from a city councilor to a member of Congress to the president, to help a country or a community navigate that change. So I think that, and what I ended up writing about, and I think what we do as an organization, is to find those leaders in a community, the pastor, the police chief, the professor, the business owner, to help communities navigate that change.
Ali Nirani says his organization, as an immigration advocate, has been working for years with traditionally conservative sectors, evangelical Christians, law enforcement, and business. The goal is to find common ground and solutions that all can support.
I want to talk about evangelical Christians for just a moment. Self-described evangelical Christians, as you know, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And yet what you're finding is that among many of those same self-described evangelical leaders, Christian leaders, you're finding a receptive audience around smart, compassionate, grace-filled immigration reform. Right. Why is that? Why do you see support for Trump in the polls, and yet you're finding some traction on immigration?
So we've been working with the conservative evangelical community since 2011, 2012. And what we've learned is that pastors, they don't want to talk about policy, about immigration policy. They certainly don't want to be in the business of talking about the politics of immigration. But they want to be able to talk about is why it is important from a scriptural basis to care for the stranger. Why it is important from the perspective of Scripture to keep families together. Why immigration is a question of life. So for us as an advocacy organization, we needed to understand what was the kind of the comfort zone. And so we built a level of trust, and more than that, on our own part, we've built a level of understanding. So we get to the election in 2016, and I would say, you know, at least half of the folks that we work with in the faith community, if not more certainly, ended up voting for President Trump. And they would say, you know, I voted for President Trump for X, Y, and Z reason, but I disagree with him on the question of immigration. Now, over the course of 2017, in the first year of the administration, with the exception maybe of the travel ban and other kind of high-profile issues, it was hard for a pastor at a national or local level to take a public position and kind of challenging the administration. I think as we went through the summer and into the fall, and it became more clear what the consequences of the administration's action around immigration was going to be, we found the faith community more willing to engage in the debate. So we've seen this building of kind of support for Dreamers from the conservative evangelical community that gets beyond politics. And I think from our perspective, you know, immigration isn't an economic issue, it's a social issue. And that's why I think the faith community is increasingly important.
Let's talk about badges.
Sure.
Why would local law enforcement be interested in this topic, and then why would they come alongside you for smart, rational immigration reform?
So one of the people we've gotten to know is Art Acevedo. He's the chief of police in Houston. His family came from Cuba as refugees. Grew up, enlisted in the army, got injured, had to leave the army, was chief of police in Austin before he, I'd say in the last 2 or 3 years, got the job in Houston. The administration comes into place, they begin to kind of beat the drum on sanctuary cities and really cracking down. Art Acevedo says publicly he's seen the rate of sexual assaults in the Latino community dropped 34%. Well, it stayed flat or increased in other communities. And he says the only reason that's the case is because the Latino community in Houston is afraid of local law enforcement. So this is all wrapped up into the debate around sanctuary cities and whether or not local law enforcement should be enforcing immigration law. So I completely understand the importance of sanctuary for the immigrant community, the importance of feeling safe and secure. But I also understand how the term sanctuary rattles people who are outside of a city or outside the immigrant community. So the way that we look at this is that I don't want to live in a sanctuary city, I want to live in a safe city. A safe city is where every cop on the corner can do their job and serve and protect everybody. And the only way they can do that is if they're trusted by everybody. So the reason, and this is very similar to our work with the faith community, is that we spent the time getting to know law enforcement. We spent the time of sitting down across the table with Republican sheriffs to Republican attorneys general to Democrats and trying to understand why do they care about this issue. And then making sure that we as an organization, me as a leader, were respectful of that perspective and then modulating our policy perspective, policy language and our personal language to, again, meet people where they are but just not leave them there.
So we've got Bibles and badges, mm-hmm. businesses.
Businesses.
What's the business case for smart immigration?
So the easy answer here is that the business case for immigration reform is access to a skilled, thriving workforce, for example, in 2015, 28% of businesses in the U.S. was started by immigrants, or 40% of Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants or children of immigrants. Those are great talking points, right? You sit there, I agree with you, but there are also terrible talking points, because I know that if I am worried I'm going to lose my job, if I'm worried that somebody's going to compete for my job at a lower wage or my job's going to go to another country, I hear that talking point and I think, gosh darn it, that immigrant is going to, I don't care if they started 28% of jobs or businesses, they're going to take my job. So that's why I think from a business perspective, it is really important to speak that business leaders are speaking to the immigrant workforce as a part of their community. And it's not just somebody who works at a business, but somebody who is part of the PTA, going to church, and really trying to humanize the immigrant workforce beyond just being kind of a cog in the wheel. And I think we have a tendency to fall into that trap, particularly in the economic perspective of just quoting statistics.
Ali Narani is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. He was speaking Monday night with Whitworth University President Beck Taylor at an event on campus. Coeur d'Alene Republican State Representative Paul Amador is a new father, and so it makes some sense that he's also the prime sponsor of a bill that would shield mothers from arrest or ticketing when they breastfeed their children in public. Amador first told me about his bill last summer before his wife gave birth, and he recently wrote to tell me his bill will get a hearing Monday in Boise.
Idaho is the only state in the country right now that doesn't provide any legal protections for breastfeeding mothers, whether they're in public or private. 49 states actually give women the right to breastfeed basically anywhere, whether it be in public or private. My legislation doesn't go that far. It basically exempts women from the public indecency statute, so it would apply while they're in public places, and so they can't be harassed, if you will. We've actually enjoyed quite a bit of success in finding co-sponsors for the legislation. So I want to say, as of right now, we have almost 40 co-sponsors.
Paul, did you get a sense as to how often, the law is enforced for women who are viewed as being indecent?
It's not as if, women are being cited or, hauled off to jail for public breastfeeding by any means in Idaho. But it was interesting. I had a conversation with another representative in the legislature and talking about this bill, and he said, well, it's funny because my daughter-in-law is a brand new mother and they have a small infant, and she was visiting Lava Hot Springs State Park, which is located in southern Idaho, and she was breastfeeding her child, and the park staff or officials approached her and indicated that she was not allowed to breastfeed in the public park, which surprised me, you know, when you think of it being a state-owned facility. And, you know, kind of the funny part being that it's also a hot springs where people are also generally standing around in swimsuits. So there's not necessarily a lot of modesty going on as it is, but it's certainly is an issue where, you know, we need to establish some sort of general acceptance from, you know, state government, and our laws need to reflect what our values are towards child rearing and child development. I think, you know, public perception and philosophy is changing on this issue. And to me, it's a matter of, you know, what's best for mothers, what's best for children, what's best for families in Idaho. And if you understand the research on breastfeeding, the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, fully endorses exclusive breastfeeding until essentially 6 months of age, when you introduce some solid foods, but until they're 1 year old. And so there's a quite a bit of evidence that this is what is absolutely best for children. And I'm certainly excited and honored to bring this legislation, in particular because I'm a new father. And so it's an important issue for me.
Interesting timing, given that your wife is a new mom. What's her experience been like?
Becoming a new mother was an interesting and very new challenge for her. And we would go on a walk in the first, you know, few weeks after our son was born. And we may be in a park, and, you know, as happens, babies get hungry quite frequently. And, you know, they start crying and screaming, and they want to be fed. And you know, you're in a situation where there really isn't anywhere to be private at that point. And she has to feed our son in a, you know, a park bench or somewhere in public. And as a new mom, you're struggling to figure out how that process works. And the baby is also struggling to figure out how to make that process work. And so, you know, to me, this legislation is for those individuals, you know, where we're kind of taking a stance as a state government to say, this is a natural process. This is something that, you know, is certainly something we want to encourage. We don't want to be viewed as a hindrance to a mother forming that, you know, really unique emotional and physiological bond with their child. I don't think I would have quite appreciated the challenges and the importance of the issue until this year.
So this has long been viewed as a woman's issue. Do you find that in 2018, it's kind of strange that it's a man who is kind of the prime sponsor of this bill?
You know, it was an interesting conversation. I always felt like having a male legislator bring forward the legislation would potentially alleviate, I guess, some of the concerns. And to me, it's not necessarily a woman's issue or a man's issue. I think it's a family issue and a children's issue. And I will, you know, also point out that on the Senate side, both of our sponsors are female legislators. And I've also asked, actually, on my side, is kind of, he's not necessarily the sponsor, but one of our co-sponsors is Representative Matt Erpelding, who is Democratic minority leader in the House. But he also has a brand new infant in his home. So it's kind of unusual in the Idaho legislature for two infants to be currently in the House. But it was unique timing, which we're trying to take advantage of.
Paul Amador is a state representative from Coeur d'Alene. His bill that would shield nursing mothers from state public indecency laws will get its first hearing on Monday. Inland journalist Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. If you've missed a segment or you want to hear the program again, the podcast is available at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can send your comments about the program to InlandJournal@kpbx.org, or leave a message on our listener line at 509-232-6904. Thank you for your support of the program and for Spokane Public Radio. Your support makes it all possible. We'll be back next week. I'm Doug Nadvornik.